I'm opening? We have an eye, sort of a nostril, two teeth. One of the teeth has a small cavity. Close call, folks, but I think we got here just in time.
Presented by Maria Menounos and Kevin Undergaro. This is Anatomy of a Movie. In-depth discussions and breakdowns of various movie titles. And now that you've seen the movie, let the dissection begin.
It's coming in.
Everything's fine.
It is coming in.
It's coming in. It's coming in hot.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Sink this music in. Because it is coming. Godzilla here on Anatomy of Movie. Which Godzilla? 2014. Godzilla. There's been a lot.
It's been a lot.
60-year anniversary, Godzilla. Yeah.
And nobody has mentioned that it's like his 60th birthday this year.
Yeah, and he didn't look a day over 40 yet.
No,
cake, no balloons.
60 he ate it. 30.
He just didn't see Although it
he
happen.
He did look like he had some cake.
Oh, yeah. He was the fat Godzilla.
Yeah.
And we have Dimitri Panos.
Hello, movie fans.
Roxy Stryer.
Hello.
John Comerford.
Hey, everybody.
And in the booth, we have Marissa Serafini.
Hello.
And I am Phil Svitek. Very excited to talk Godzilla. I love this music. I love this movie. It was a lot of fun. But I love just the premise, you know, as I did more and more research, I love the premise of Godzilla as a reaction to post-war Japanese culture.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of, like, all these things, you know, come from, it all deals with nuclear war.
Yep.
And as a byproduct of that and what that fully means. So I thought that, you know, that was really interesting, and to see the evolution, you know, how that's still kind of relevant today in some sort of evolutionary form. And, you know, this is the movie that we get.
Yeah. When current events affect films in a larger way, in a more abstract way, as opposed to movies that are based absolutely on that event, it's interesting to see what form they can take.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I've watched Godzilla. I can't say that I'm like the number one fan, but I've come to know enough about Godzilla, and I've watched Godzilla enough times. But it actually, for me, it was only until a few years ago, I want to say within the past five, 10 years, that I actually realized that there was an original Japanese version mm-hmm. of Godzilla, because I was brought up watching Raymond Burr Ironsides. Mm-hmm. As play Steve Martin in the Godzilla, and I only recently found out, like I said, that there's a Japanese version. I bought
the
original
version.
Yeah, the original version. And then just recently, I was fortunate enough, I got to see director Gareth Edwards. He actually opened and hosted a screening of that Japanese version at the Turner Classic Film Festival, and got to see it on the big screen. And yeah, I mean, Godzilla, born of the atomic age, and as a metaphor, and seeing the Japanese version, which thematically is a hell of a lot more dour than the version that we got with Raymond Burr. But even more importantly, from a film fan, the Raymond Burr one is a classic. I mean, if I were a film teacher, I would say this is a classic example of great editing, because, you know, when one of his metamorphoses, Godzilla's metamorphosis, is, you got to remember at the time that it was. So 1954 Japanese Godzilla, and it was like 55, 56, an American producer had seen it and go, wow, it was the craze of the monster movie in the States.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, oh, this, we got to get this monster over here. And he worked out this deal with Toho, but we're not going to watch a subtitled movie. Yeah. There was no American stars in it. At the time, mm-hmm. Raymond Burr was an up-and-coming big star people could recognize. So they hired him to do these scenes.
Vignettes, shall we say.
And they basically re-edited it.
Put him in the movie.
They put him in the movie. And he's almost like Forrest Gump or Zelig. I mean,
Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. I mean, they had the original.
Dead Men Don't Wear, and he's interacting with these people, but there's never a time when there's like a two-shot of them. You're always seeing from over the shoulder. But again, as a kid watching it, you don't know.
Exactly.
But the re-edit is just as classic. It's just not as dour. And throughout the years, like for me, this Godzilla, I'll say, I loved it. I had a great time. I will say my caveat was that I saw it about a month ago, and up to that point, the marketing sort of kind of led me astray because I was expecting a certain kind of Godzilla movie, and that was Godzilla as the Destroyer, mm-hmm. you know, and the movie I got was the second kind of a Godzilla movie, which is the Godzilla versus whatever.
Mothra, whatever it
is. Yeah, and
in this case, Mutos.
Mutos, and as I was just letting the movie wash over me, I was like, okay, this is fine. I didn't see that in the marketing. They cleverly hid that, but ultimately, it had everything that I could have hoped for. It was a good, fun summer movie. Good blockbuster way for me to kick off the summer. I enjoyed it. And then reading about it, I love the lore of Godzilla, and mm-hmm. some of the cable channels have been showing some of the older Godzilla when he would do a little
dance.
I was entertained from start to finish, so I will give it a round of applause there. I thought it was really good. Some of the relationships, the human elements of it, were a little off to me. Mm-hmm. But the watching it in IMAX 3D, it was so visually thrilling that I honestly didn't really care much about that. It was beautiful. Beautiful. Even when it was horrific, it was beautiful. So yeah. I really appreciated that.
Yeah, what's your foray into Godzilla?
I know him from early on. I mean, I remember seeing Godzilla versus Mothra. I even remember seeing Son of Godzilla. All of those things. Saturday morning, because by the time I got to see him, they were all Saturday morning TV movies that you could see. Saturday morning, afternoon, whatever. So that's where I know
Creature
him.
Double feature we
yeah,
had.
And I even saw the 1998 version with Matthew Broderick, I saw that. So
and it was your
I'm
favorite
committed.
Movie of all time?
Oh, clearly.
Clearly, in 1998.
Nothing has come close to even touching the tale of Godzilla in 1998. but anyway, I'm not as a fan of it as you guys were. I was rather kind of bored. Mm. I found it very lackluster, and I was.
Is it because there's clearly not a lot of Godzilla in the movie. Is that why?
Part of it is that. I mean, I understand he was taking the Spielberg approach, you know, don't show the shark until halfway through. Of course, Spielberg had reasons for that because the shark didn't work. But in this case, everybody knows Godzilla. I want to see Godzilla. Like, bring him out. What's the suspense? What are you hiding? What are you holding back? I don't know. And then it really bothered me, like the first time we get to him when he's in Honolulu, they're just about to get to each other, and then they cut away to show what's her name in San Francisco. It's like, why are we doing that? Yeah, I say what's her name specifically because I didn't care a whit.
That was my problem.
It's like, why are you bothering? And then we only get to see the aftermath. So the fun of seeing the monsters go at it is lost because we don't get to see any of it. And how do you go to Vegas and not really show what the heck he's doing to Vegas?
Yeah.
Except on a little tiny screen. And I went, why are you cut? That's the fun stuff.
Yeah, you know, it's very I think
drove
it brings
me
up
nuts.
Well, I think that I think your point and I get your point because it's been echoed through audience and even some critics as well, but I was pondering this and thinking about this, and I'm going, geez, are we as movie going audience, are we conditioned to wanting to see everything up on screen? And then we can somehow complain about it because I look at the Transformer movies and it's like, oh my God, the Transformer movies. And, you know, the big complaint is, oh, there's too much going on and they're all up on screen. And we see right from the get go, there's a fight between a machine and a robot and all this. And in today's movies, they usually do show that.
Yeah. And I would agree with that. But my point was that you got maybe 10 minutes of the entire movie of those monsters going at it.
Yeah,
that's what you got.
And
you had to wait 2 hours to get it. And I just think you have three scenes where you can, in Honolulu is the first one.
Right.
And in Vegas, there's monsters, not going at each other, but there's monsters. The only time you get to see in San Francisco, and I go, and then there was just 10 minutes of it.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying you need to flood the entire movie of it, because I agree with you. I think that's too much.
So
but for me, this is just way out of balance.
So what's a Godzilla movie in the past for you that, you know, hits the standard and that's the mark?
Unfortunately, I wouldn't be able to discern which ones because I would get Mothra and Armageddon or whatever the heck.
Mechagodzilla.
Yeah, exactly. I can't remember.
Mechagodzilla 2.
Because they kind
Godzilla
of blend together.
King Kong.
But for me, this was just out of balance in that regard because I loved it. Always going to Vegas. How much fun would that be? I'm trying to liken it to a movie that had a better balance, and the one I go to was Jurassic Park, because you had to wait a long time to see our Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But then when you did, you got a couple of sequences where you could see the danger there and you could really get involved. And this one, it just waited way too long to get to that.
Yeah.
But what was the benefit if we had seen them fighting more? You just would have been more entertained?
Okay, since I just brought Jurassic Park, the first time you get to see the Tyrannosaurus Rex when they're out there, I don't know if you recall, and they see, you know, you get the water in the cup, you know, vibrating and stuff. Right. And then you get to see him, and they get the chase scene with the car, and he actually eats the lawyer on. So there's just, that's a fun sequence. Now, it's not a huge long sequence, but
it's about 20 minutes.
Yeah, but you really get to feel like, I'm there with the kids, and the Tyrannosaurus Rex is about ready to eat me.
Yeah.
And I think that's hugely beneficial for the end sequence.
So you needed to be sucked in more and feel like you were
just
there.
You know, and the other thing is it's a monster movie. I want to see those monsters. And all of a sudden, the only way I got to see them, I mean, granted, Godzilla's not there in Vegas, but it would have been fun. How much fun would it have been to see that huge Muto tear down Vegas?
But we, you know, and it's interesting. Get to see it. But and to me, why I liked sort of kind of Gareth Edwards sort of kind of pullback on this, because he uses a technique that he used in his first movie a lot. And whether it's for budgetary reason or whatnot,
that's what
where
it
he
like
would
to me.
He would cut away to like a video monitor. To me, and I especially like the second time that I saw that Godzilla, this sort of kind of hit me too, is he created for me a suspense. Like, so he would cut to like Godzilla and they're about to like go head to head. And then you're right. He makes that cut.
It's obvious. It's a specific choice. He's not doing it. No, by accident.
No, it's not by accident. But what he did, but the first thing we see in that cut is the kid watching TV and the fight going on.
Yeah.
So we see, and then it pulls back and the mother comes in and, you know, it's that newscast. But to me, that was like, it was a sign that he got me hooked, because I did want to see, and you're watching it, and because
if,
for me,
if
every time
end
Godzilla
was a much better sequence, then I probably wouldn't be upset about
really,
it. Because, but the end sequence wasn't near enough, good enough for me.
Because for me, Godzilla, every time Godzilla was on screen, I thought the money shot paid off for me. Yeah. Like, I saw Godzilla do what I wanted him to do.
The one shot with him ripping and spinning down the guy's throat.
Here's the thing.
That was awesome.
That was cool.
That was great.
But that was the one. I was like,
but I think it just feels so earned at that point that you can't help but cheer and be like, yes.
Well, you guys did it for me. No.
Yeah, no. And again, that has been. No, listen, it's been a complaint. And it has been a legit complaint. Again, audience members have said, when I saw it actually, because I saw it, like I said, a couple of months ago at a trade screening, which is a screening that is held for exhibitors. And I remember walking out of it, and I overheard a couple of these exhibitors talking, and these are like people part of the theater chains and whatnot. And the quote was, geez, for a movie called Godzilla, we don't have much Godzilla in the movie.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, you know, I got what that gentleman was saying. Mm-hmm. But again, for me, my thing was, the first time I was just, it was almost like a bait and switch. Mm-hmm. I thought it was going to be a Godzilla Destroyer. So I had to let that wash over me that's not the movie this was going to be. And then when I mulled it over, I actually appreciated it more. And then when I saw it the second time and I did see it in XD 3D, I was like, okay, it looked great. And again, it just further, it paid off. Like, when we see Godzilla, like, to me, the Honolulu, when the way that scene was directed that involved the tsunami coming in, and the way his camera moved, like, goes up the hotels and all the lights were going off, and then it goes, like, you see the people on the rooftop, and it goes farther up and you see the soldiers on, which you didn't even know they were there, and they start shooting up their little flare guns. And then they're just like going up to this this huge monster. And for a monster movie too, the other thing I loved was their scale. They actually were
the tallest Godzilla
ever. Yeah. Well, you know, and he wasn't a man in a suit.
No.
Like, when they put the original Godzilla, the man in the suit, you know, they would build scale models, and they just put a guy in a rubber suit who'd walk on it, and they'd film it in slow motion. He was bigger than the buildings, but this guy was huge. Massive. He was massive.
He was 355 feet tall.
Yeah, that's matched by girth. I mean,
exactly.
He was huge. Like, there was no way he wasn't going to knock down a building.
Yeah. You know? It's just so funny to me listening to you guys talk about your favorites. You love the fire-breathing scene or these Godzilla things. And maybe this is because you guys are action men and I'm just like I don't know. But my favorite scene with him was when we see him walking away and he's done all of this and he goes back in. And I was like, yes, yeah, that's my champion. Godzilla. Yeah. And I'm sitting here like, oh, this is such a feel-good moment. Mm-hmm. And then I look around. I'm like, it's completely destroyed. Yeah, everything's been destroyed.
And everybody's like cheering him on. It's like he doesn't. That was another thing I loved about this movie, too, is in each scene where he's with people or humans, like, it was great. Like, as he's swimming towards Honolulu and, like, you know, they're the aircraft carriers. He's not paying them. He doesn't care.
I know. He's just like they're plotting like he gives a crap.
Yeah, and he's just like swimming through. He's like, who are you?
Like, so you liked his personality. He was friendly.
His personality was great because he didn't. Again, what I liked about this movie, going back to the start of this podcast, was Godzilla was a force of nature, and he was to represent like the balance in that nature. And you know, he's like a tsunami. He's like a tornado. Like you can't stop that. And he was just there. He was the apex predator. Like these mutas come alive, and he's like, oh, time to work. And he gets up, he works, and he's like, all right.
And then he gets tired.
Then he gets up, and people are like, yay.
Like the lion on the savannah.
I don't care. He's like, you puny little humans. You know, to me, I love that because he has, no interaction. He's not like a puppy dog. He's not like, hey, look what I did. He's just like, in a day's work. Yep, time to go back to the ocean. And everybody's like cheering him on. I'm like, did you just turn around and look what happened in San Francisco? I think it was my mom, who our audience of one today. My mom's here from Boston. Woo! She was like, thank you.
Welcome.
She was like, oh, I want to go to San Francisco. I said, you can't go to San Francisco. She goes, what do you mean? I go, I took you to the movie. Like, did you see what he did to San Francisco?
It's a mess.
It's a mess. But it is funny that, and again, this is something else I was thinking of, a movie that came out last year, Man of Steel. Mm-hmm. One of the things people criticized a ton was the fight that took place in Metropolis and how this Titan fight like literally leveled Metropolis and lives had to have been lost. And people are like going, oh my God, the wanton disregard of life in this movie. And I'm like watching Godzilla or I'll watch a movie like the Avengers. I'm like, going, what's the difference?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't get it. Like, how do you buy into, I mean, Godzilla, I mean, the body count would
but we didn't see any of it.
No.
We just forget it.
And it did seem as if they were trying, like they knew that, they were trying to get people into shelters,
so to speak.
But I don't know. For me, the money shots where Godzilla was in it, they paid off. To your point, you expect it, and it delivered to me. But I see the flip side of the coin if you're expecting a lot of Godzilla, and you're not going to get it.
So let's take a step back because, we make light of the 1998 Matthew Broderick Godzilla, but TriStar at the time had the rights to all that, and I believe it was Toho who said, they specifically wouldn't make another Godzilla for 10 years.
Yeah.
And so now you have this movie that comes, finally kind of TriStar. I don't know the full thing of it, but they released their hold or whatever, and now Warner Brothers and these guys can do it.
Yeah, Legendary came in as well as co-financiers, and Warner Brothers, at the time, they had their deal with Legendary. Warner Brothers is going to release this movie, and they've been promoting the movie for better part of the year. I remember hearing about it at Comic-Con.
Yeah, in 2012.
So, it's been being talked about. And again, I think that what was it, 1998, Godzilla left a bad taste in so many people's mouths that to hear that, I think there was a little bit of trepidation at first, but once, they signed in this director and they cleverly leaked out that this is the path we're going. You're not going to see.
Speaking of that, they leaked a lot of like 4-minute sequences and things of that nature. Here's what you can watch, and so there was a lot of anticipation built up for it. By the way, it's ironic the TV community too, because it was like, oh, the Breaking Bad guy's in it.
Yeah,
I know exactly.
So I mean, Breaking Bad guy. Like literally, I don't know how many fans that accounts for, but it's like, I got to go see the Breaking Bad guy.
And then he was in 5 minutes of the movie.
No, he wasn't. He was.
I know. I was sad because I love Bryan Cranston. And then all of us, even I swear to God, to the moment he's being on the helicopter, he's being hooked up to IVs, like saying his last words. I'm like, he'll be fine. He's fine.
No, he's a Breaking Bad guy. They're not going to kill him.
We got another hour here. He's okay. And then dead. And I was like, oh.
Yeah,
are they tricking us? Is he coming back?
Real fast about Bryan Cranston, because I don't want to get too far off subject, but I think he set a really good tone. I mean, for the first 30 minutes, he basically, you could buy into the fact that this is the, you're like, wait, why was his name the first name? Because he could have been the star.
Right.
And I thought he did such a great job carrying the movie. And then they switched in. But he really, they put a lot on his shoulders initially. Mm-hmm. And I think it paid off well.
Yeah, I agree with you.
It didn't for me, because once he was gone, it lost a lot of its weight that I would have liked to remain. Because then you're left with the other stuff, and the other stuff wasn't as interesting to me.
I was so invested in him that once he was gone, I was like, well, my leading man just left me, and now I don't really know who to follow, because I wasn't fully on board with his son and his son's wife. I just wasn't fully on their team. Mm-hmm. So I'm with you that I could have used him to last longer. Maybe die in the end, maybe not.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it was a very, I mean, when it happened, it was a little bit Janet Leigh psycho, kind of like, wow, I can't believe they're killing him off. And again, I'm going to point this towards the marketing. The marketing set him up that we're going to follow this character because he had great lines. He's like, you know, it's going to send you back to the Stone Age, or that wasn't a typhoon, that wasn't an earthquake, you know, and he goes, and it's coming. And the great thing about marketing, you think he's talking about Godzilla, but it wasn't. It didn't end up being Godzilla. So again, it was that little bait and switch thing that we get from the marketing that we didn't realize that we're going to be following Aaron Johnson's character, or who plays his son,
Ford,
and what I sort of kind of appreciated is at least you got to see it was the passing of the torch in a sense, because the son's going and he's like, oh, geez, Dad, come on, get over it. Mm-hmm. But the son gets to see that his father wasn't the crazy scientist that a lot of people had painted him to be. Mm-hmm. And, you know, yes, did you lose a little gravitas by losing Bryan Cranston? You did. But I liked how Ford picked up where he went off, and at least knowing that his dad wasn't a nut job.
That's one of the reasons why I had a challenge with it, because the whole reason why Bryan Cranston goes crazy, well, not the whole reason, but a big reason, is because he's the one that told his wife to go down there. That's the reason why she died. So you have that motivation for him being so obsessive about what happened. Then, boom, 10 minutes later, now he's the guy that dies, and you pass on that. You're trying to pass on that emotion to the kid, his son. I was just like, you just diluted everything. And I was invested as Roxy was saying, I was invested in Bryan Cranston and Julia Binoche.
Yeah.
And then I was like, oh, now I'm going to now you want me to just transfer all that over to the kid? And I was like, well, that's too much of a stretch for me. Yeah. And you didn't need that. You could have done it without. You could have just started with Cranston being arrested, and I would have been fine. You wouldn't even need the whole setup.
Well, yeah, I like the setup only because it did set up that something was wrong. And because aside from him being, I'm trying to think how you just put it, aside from him losing his wife, it was like he was the early obsessive warning guy.
Yeah.
I mean, he saw this coming, like that whole sequence in his house when he's on the phone. He's like, listen, I understand, but there are tremors. Mm-hmm. And these tremors, they started off in the Philippines. He goes, how come I'm the only one who's concerned about this? He goes, I'm talking about a nuclear power plant here. He goes, we got to be monitoring this and whatever. And yes, he was the person that also sent his wife down. But he was the early warning guy. He was the guy that said, hey, the sky's about to fall. You guys aren't listening to me. Mm-hmm. He goes, I could try to, you know, you got to listen to me and shut everything down. But it was too late.
Right. In the scene that we see his wife actually die, which I thought was a great scene, the last word she says, which I suppose we're foreshadowing, is something about Ford.
Take care of Ford.
Take care of Ford. So I don't know. I thought that was going to lead to Ford teaming up with his dad. Absolutely. I didn't think he was going to be the enemy of the movie. I didn't think he was never going to get on his dad's page, but right. I needed them
whatever
as a duo.
Whatever it takes, I think is the word she said.
Yeah, whatever it takes. Yes. So I needed them as a pair, which we never got to see because the dad was dead by the time the son was fully on that team, which was upsetting because it was like this can never be reconciled because now he's gone. It just left like a pit in my stomach that wasn't filled with the rest of the movie.
Yeah. And it's interesting too that, you know, the Breaking Bad fans must have thought, oh, he's going into a Godzilla movie? Or what? How's that gonna? But, you know, I mean, I remember hearing him about a month ago on Howard Stern, and they brought up Godzilla, and he couldn't talk much about the movie, but he was like, he goes, you know, I'm proud of what the director did, and he gave props to the director. He goes, you know, I'm glad to be in it. But again, he didn't suggest that he was dying within the first 20 minutes to a half hour of the film.
Yeah, kind of be a big spoiler, I think.
Yeah, but he's had kind things to say, which is good. But I think Aaron Johnson's character was, you know, his thing was trying to get back home, and something else would sort of veer him off the path. And
yeah, but that whole storyline about whatever it takes, and that's what his dad says to his wife says to him, that's what the dad says to the son, and then that thread gets lost like crazy, and that whole connection between family kind of gets lost because, you know, then there's the kid he sees on the subway, the tramway, and that's supposed to, it just
we keep
bye-bye.
Following these kids, like the person on the tram who lost his parents, and then when we've got the big tsunami coming, there's this little blonde girl that we follow for a few minutes, and I kept thinking, what is the significance of all these children? Is there a bigger message here?
To let it remind us of what's at stake.
Yeah, I suppose that's what it was. It missed the mark for me, and this movie was a little long for me. I felt like we could have easily cut some of those parts.
Because for me, if they had done a little bit more work on the family thing, on those storylines, that would have been fine. Because I just think it was out of balance because they didn't do enough work on those to make them work. So if you're not really going to make them work, just get rid of them.
Yeah,
and have it be just the monster movie.
Absolutely. When finally, you know, Elle is home with Sam, the little boy, and then she sends him on this bus, and I'm thinking, what are you doing? Why are you sending your son? Yeah. You know, I didn't feel like that's the right parenting move. I was like, go with your kid.
And I'll go
and find you.
And it's funny that you say that because The Impossible, which is based on a true story, that's exactly what happens. Like a parent like takes, here, I want you to go on this bus with a bunch of strangers to take care of you.
I didn't find it unrealistic. I just didn't. I just didn't want it. You know?
Yeah, I was like, wow, what parent would do that? And this is supposed to be based on, you know, so it didn't bother me seeing it in Godzilla that she was trying to get her son off to safety, and it was with somebody that she actually knew.
Right, but your son's going to be an orphan. You know, you're sending your son away because you think that you guys are going to blow up.
That's different than trying to find.
Right. I just was like,
yeah, it didn't work for me either.
You're caring more about your husband and being with him than you are about your son, which is supposed to be the ultimate in this movie, the way they've set it up.
And I believe you know that your son's also lost his grandfather.
He doesn't know that yet.
She knows that.
No, I think he called and he said, left a message saying he's gone.
Well, the kid doesn't know that.
I'm saying. The mother knows. Like, you know, the kid's...
fair enough.
It just didn't work for me.
He has literally nobody if you stay
here. That's my point. Yeah. It's like, I don't think that would be...
Not the move. As a parent, it's just not the move. But I guess it's better to do that than to keep him...
Get your kid out of harm's way. It's not like you couldn't find your husband after that.
Yeah. Not and still have your kid.
Exactly.
Well, parenting aside.
But I'm sorry. But let me be specific. The reason why that doesn't work for me is it doesn't. You're trying to make this storyline play about family and what's important and those things, and it doesn't work. And I'm going, didn't anybody question that? Didn't anybody have a better way to handle that or fix that? Because for me, it didn't play out at all. Maybe it didn't bother you, but
it didn't bother me.
But I don't think it actually created what it wanted to.
Right.
It didn't. Why? There's a difference between it didn't bother me or no, that really worked.
Yeah.
And I don't think it worked.
Yeah,
it's not going to work. Get rid of it.
It should be we stick together, or you know. But I'm with you. Like you're saying, it didn't bother you, but did it add anything for you that she did that?
What, that she put the son away? I mean, no. I mean, I understand why. And again, to me, it wasn't like she was she was putting the son off with a complete stranger. You know, and they were only going to like some sort of, you know, they were.
But it also, it flies in the face of what they set up. She says, take care of Ford, whatever it takes. And here she is, left with the same decision. She should take care of Ford, whatever it takes, but she gives them to somebody else to take
care
of.
Right, the way that the movie kept showing.
And that kind of flies in the face of that whole thing.
It's well, all about the kid. Take care of the kid. Take care of the next generation.
We don't know how well Bryan Cranston's character took care of his kid because he was so obsessed.
True, clearly.
With,
but,
yeah.
but I know. Yeah. I agree with you, but it's just... Very much that's so. What I'm saying. It doesn't... It just didn't carry through.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
I get it.
Well, so, Dimitri, you had mentioned that there's 8 very specific things that the director, Gareth Edwards, wanted to make sure that happened.
Yeah.
I'm excited.
To make
it
as a Godzilla movie.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The first one, he said, use the original as an inspiration, not a template, which he did. Mm-hmm. I thought he did a great job at doing that.
Well, and they had to a little bit because then was it Toho? I guess that said, yeah, well, no, whomever said, we'll license it to you, but you have to make sure things are still in. What was the deal? They had to make sure that Godzilla still was because of an
nuclear. Yeah.
So there's some things you're kind of limited to.
One of the, they made this much more obviously like the Godzilla in terms of this dinosaur versus a lizard, which the 1998
right.
So they were very conscious of that. Yeah. So is that point number 2? Is that at least one of the points?
It's actually to make it modern. Godzilla is nature's revenge, mm-hmm. and again that's sort of kind of an ode to the original, where you know he is nature's revenge or.
For us, mining and depleting the earth of its resources. Is that
yeah, one? And you know, and, yeah. and using that stuff to, you know, when you're using like the H bomb and atomic energy and things like that. The other one is the next one on the list is the wrath of a kaiju is better when we deserve it, and I get that too, mm-hmm. and because the wrath of Godzilla in the original Japanese version, mm-hmm. He's a metaphor. He is a walking fire-breathing H-bomb that just mm-hmm. goes into mm-hmm. Tokyo.
This is your karmic.
Yeah, this is what you get. Yeah. Like, when you're going to play around with these things, you're going to awaken something, and it's going to come and haunt you. Mm-hmm. There are some scenes in that Japanese version that are just, like, you go, wow, okay. It's amazing that the Japanese filmmakers were able to put that kind of a movie together because it was as much a criticism about the Japan culture and the mm-hmm. testing of H-bombs mm-hmm. as it was about, like, Hiroshima is mentioned in mm-hmm. the movie and all. So it's sort of kind of amazing that they allowed the film to be made mm-hmm. at all. His next one is also add more kaiju. So, again, like, you know, for me, kaiju came up from last year's Pacific Rim. I had mm-hmm. really never not been familiar with the term before, but add more monsters. Now, he did that, I think. And again, just going back to an earlier point, I didn't realize that there were going to be 2. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize it was going to be a fight, Godzilla. But, you know, and Breaking Bad star who took some convincing. So you get in Bryan Cranston, who sort of kind of legitimizes your project, mm-hmm. which he did, yeah. and Warner Brothers hung their marketing on him. I mm-hmm. mean, I did not know that Aaron Johnson was going to be mm-hmm. the star.
And like, I believe it was the scene with Juliet, that last scene, that convinced him, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, losing his wife.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he said no thank you to the role, but after sending Cranston a screenplay and showing him Edwards' last feature, Monsters, the actor agreed. I think he was just cautious because there's definitely a bad version of this film.
Yeah.
And he didn't want the stink on him, and I don't think he has stink on him.
I don't think anybody does.
Right. And then it says, get help from Godzilla's makers at Toho, mm-hmm. which makes sense. And, you know, when you see the 1998 version, you just wonder, like, did they even take heed to anything Toho had to say or whatever? Mm-hmm. But, you know, the Japanese film company, which still owns the character and they aggressively protect it, mm-hmm. You know, they weighed in a lot. He goes, Gareth Edwards says, my favorite thing was meeting Yoshimitsu Banno. He did Godzilla vs. the Smog Monster. And when I met him, took great pride in showing me this book and why was he showing me, and then I looked at the book and the worst movies ever made in there, and this was in there. Godzilla versus the Smog Monster. So, you know, he didn't care because he was the assistant director and he got so many great other movies to his name. But the point being is, look, I made one of these movies and it's on the top worst list.
There you go.
Be careful, like what you're treading into. Aim to be big in Japan. That was another one. Yeah. And again, you wouldn't necessarily think that you would take so much care, but he did. And he's like, the folks at Toho are so excited of the film and supportive. You want your version to be a version of something that is so much part of Japan culture. And again, when you look at, we talked about this, when you look at Godzilla, what he's become to Japan and the world. I mean, he went from being a destroyer to hero to major pop icon, where the Japanese people like idolize Godzilla. And the first movie, he leveled Tokyo, but he's just become such a huge pop culture icon. To protect that, I think, is a really cool thing. You were going to.
Well, I was just going to wonder, how did the film do in Japan? I know how the film did overall, but does anybody know?
I don't know specifically.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's. I'm not sure if they open day and date. I know. Internationally, it's done very well.
I'm just curious about the numbers in Japan.
You know, and then make Godzilla strong enough to stand alone, but don't rule out a sequel. And I'm sure that may have come from the studio. Like,
of course,
you know,
yeah. You have to spend all that much money and not have a sequel.
Well, even 1998, they had the egg at the end where it just hatched and they left it open. By the way, you know, it's funny that catered to a Japanese audience. I know, like, silent black and white Japanese movies where all they talk about is a wedding, and you never see the wedding. So you know what? It actually might... I don't know the Japanese culture well enough, but in terms of not seeing the action as much as you're saying, it could literally be... If they're... I don't know. It's a guess of mine that if they're catering to a specific Japanese audience first and foremost, that could be part of the reason.
I think that he definitely conquered his last point of making this standalone and be a sequel with the way that Godzilla walks off.
Yeah.
But I want to go back to your second point about nature. I don't know exactly what it said, but
about nature's
balance.
Make
it modern, Godzilla is nature's revenge.
Right. So what the doctor kept saying, this was his quote over and over again, nature has an order, a power to restore balance. I believe he is that power. What did you guys think about that? It was... Throughout the entire movie, we keep talking about Godzilla being this power and let them fight and whatever it was. Did you feel like that was strong enough and you were on that page, or were you questioning him also, or did you think this was nature's way of restoring its balance? Was that strong enough for you guys?
I mean, it's a very Eastern type of philosophy. So in that sense, I'm familiar with it. You know, Final Fantasy VII, for example, the video games, there's always these monsters that are more humongous than any of us can ever imagine that have some sort of balance, and they come out to do something with the Earth for, you know, because humans can't. And obviously it happened because of the bombings and nukes and things of that nature, so.
I think, you know, because it's a very interesting question, I think I went along with it because I was going, yeah, let them fight, let's go, let's get it.
Yeah, you're like, oh yeah, it's a balance, go ahead.
Let's go, fight, let's get it on. That's where I was.
I didn't need him necessarily repurposing those words every single time. Yeah. I think he was trying to say the same argument many different ways.
I did like the argument. I thought it was an interesting theme to put in there because I think we have such hubris about what we think we can control and what we can't. So I liked that theme.
I wish him and the general did go more toe-to-toe. And, you know, I get partly that, you know, when it's more of a faith-based thing that you can't necessarily prove it. You know, the doctor's always going to be in less position by that nature arguments. But I think they could have fought
that
a little bit more.
Absolutely, because that would, you know, echo what we saw outside. Right. You know, the big guys fighting and everything like that. And you also have David Strathairn and Ken Watanabe. Give them something to play, except rather than the same thing every time.
Exactly.
You know, but to me, if you had David Strathairn's character, to me, walked a very fine line because and number one, he wanted to be a peacemaker, and everybody's thrown into this situation where, what the fuck, this 380
people,
what do we do with like these monsters? And David Strathairn, like, okay, we're either going to like wipe them out. He goes, but you're saying just to let them fight, you know, and everything they've done up to that point, I'm not even entirely sure that their end game plan with setting off that bomb. Yeah. was going to do anything.
Right.
Like, I'm not even entirely sure, no, but it would have done a hell of a lot of damage to everything else around there. Mm-hmm. So to me, it sort of kind of strengthens Watanabe's character, who's Dr. Sazawa, who, that name right there is a throwback to the original Godzilla, because there was a Dr. Sazawa in the original Godzilla. He was the gentleman that invented the oxygen destroyer, and he was the guy, self-sacrifice, who went into the ocean and set it open and killed Godzilla. So that's a...
Well, and his first name is Ishiro, which is the first name of the director.
Honda.
Ishiro Honda, exactly.
So. I thought, you know, where...
Thank you for the Easter eggs, people.
The 1998 version of Godzilla, although not as what I liked about Matthew Broderick's character is that he used the knowledge that he had to his advantage. And I think although, you know, again, Ken's character, the doctor, wasn't in a high position, I think by the end he could have gained some of this knowledge and could have been like, okay, here's, you know, you've tried your nuclear bomb on the train.
No,
greatest idea I've ever heard. And that failed.
Brilliant.
Nobody had any really good ideas or used, because even our lead, Ford, he's the bomb expert. He doesn't have to defuse the bomb. He just takes it away.
Right.
So even that, I was like, why are you setting all this up and never paying it off?
Exactly.
So I agree with you completely. Why did, because you would love those nuggets and they weren't there.
The reason I posed this question to you guys about the nature thing is because I thought this was one of the most intriguing parts of the entire film. But I didn't know the answer. You know, I wanted them to debate this. Do we take action, or is it not acting enough of an action? They'll do it themselves. I thought that was really cool, and like you guys were saying, I wanted to see them go toe-to-toe a little more because that was cool to me. Yeah. Is this something that has to happen? Do we have any control over this, or do we have to just sit back and kind of run and hide a little bit?
Well, and that was Tozawa's point, and to me, what I gathered from that, you know, he's like, look, you got to let nature run its course. And see.
Right.
And then came the great line to me is like, let them fight. You know, let them fight. That's the only way that you're going to, yeah, there's going to be some casualty. There's going to be some damage done. He goes, but it's the only way you're going to cure this problem is, and because Godzilla is a force of nature. And, you know, he was, we created him, and he's been feeding off of, or these Mutos have been feeding off radiation. And the only way, you know, another bomb blast isn't going to help you. It's only probably going to make things worse. So let them fight, and then Godzilla will go away until another Muto comes along. And that'll be part two.
I agree that if you had stronger arguments, or if they had at least made the arguments in a better form, it would have elevated the movie. It would have made it much more rich for me.
But then would Statham's character become more caricature of the general who just wants to fight, war, blow things
up?
No,
I don't think so. I mean, I don't know why, but I flashed on in The Siege and Bruce Willis's character.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah, I remember that movie.
Because he had some complexity to him, and the fact that, look, I'm a blunt object, and, you know, there are times when you need that, and there are times when you don't want that used. So I think if you had had the – because I love the argument, look – you're going to make it worse. And he goes, yeah, but all these people are going to die if we just sit back and do nothing. That's a great argument, because there's no answer, but it's great drama and it's great conflict. But it really, I think if you elucidated that a little bit more, articulated it better, it would have been much more interesting.
Interesting.
We already talked a little bit about physical Godzilla. What did you guys think of the Mutos and how they looked?
Well, first of all, I didn't say no. I hated the way Godzilla
looked. Oh, really?
Really?
When the first time I saw his foot, I was like, what is that, an elephant? I was just like, what is that? And I did not like him. I wanted him to look
more badass,
lithe. No. But I wanted him to look more badass, lithe. You know, he looked like, it's like,
he kind of
what?
Looked like a clump.
He did. He was a little muppety. For
when he lit up, when his
that part was fabulous.
Oh my god! Then he looked really cool. But other than that, I was like, he looks like a piece of coal, kind of like a blown up beast.
Yeah,
here's the thing. The Mutos were so crazy looking, and Godzilla.
But here's you wrote down this note, Roxy. Fun facts by Roxy. I haven't printed them out here. They wanted the appearance of Godzilla to be very scarred because of the bombings and whatever else, and to be a true product of, you know, of nukes.
And they wanted him to, like, it's interesting. When I was at that screening, one of the things Gareth Edwards said was, my one of the hardest things to do in creating Godzilla, like creating the character Godzilla, is what personality am I going to give him?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, and he needs to have a personality. If you watch him in the movies, you know, the
and we keep
Toho
saying he,
movies,
we don't even know. Is it he?
You know, and he yeah. goes, he always has a personality. He goes, now, one thing I was going to stay away from was, you know, you were not going to get the dancing jig Godzilla, you know, popping up. And he goes, we stayed away from that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. To me, this Godzilla had a personality. Mm-hmm. To me, he was, as you said, he was the tallest mm-hmm. that, you know, and I have always pictured, like, just because growing up watching Godzilla, that this thing is taller than any building on the planet, mm-hmm. and he'll just knock it down with his tail without mm-hmm. even realizing what he's doing. And mm-hmm. To me, they captured that. I thought it was awesome.
I didn't find it to have much of a personality at all.
Really?
Yeah, I would have much rather, you know, I just wanted to see him thinking almost like, and again, I'm only using it because it's demonstrable. In Jurassic Park, you can see the velociraptors thinking, figuring things out, you know, mm-hmm. how to trap them and how to.
That would work well with the doctor if he, because I know he was watched, the
right.
remember, he was watching him he's, from the boat.
Yeah, and it would have been interesting to see, because here he is, he's the tip of the food chain. And I wanted to see him figuring out how to get, oh shoot, there's two of them. How do I deal with this? And you didn't really get it. Just it was nothing there. I didn't see any personality.
I was somewhere in between you guys. His physical appearance was to me. Sometimes it was better
she
than others.
Like fat boys.
No, he's just kind of a baby Huey kind of thing.
But then when I did think he had personality.
See, he was more Godzilla the Hutt, I think. It was like,
but I did one. Like when he made eye contact with Ford. Uh-huh. I was like, oh, I see it. I see something there. I would have liked some more of those moments.
That's what I mean. Give me some more of
those. Yeah, some more of those. But I do think he had personality. It was a little bit of a, I don't care about anything personality, but I guess that is a personality.
Well, I mean, again, when he's the apex predator.
Yeah.
And, you know, at the time, and it's like, okay, but here I am going back to work. I'm going to swim. I'm going to take care of this problem. And it wasn't like he was going to, like, oh, you humans, I'm going to take care of this problem with you. Mm-hmm. It's just like, hey, I'm out for the hunt. Mm-hmm. And here I am. I'm this big great white shark. And all right, here's what I got to fight. I'm going to take these guys down. It's like, oh, there's two of them. All right, that's good. You know, and again, I'm going to sort of kind of harken back to those older Godzilla movies where, I don't know, Godzilla would fight two, like he'd fight like Ghidorah mm-hmm. and Mothra and all these other, anything else they'd throw at him. Mm-hmm. And there was always the time in those movies, if they sort of kind of followed the Toho model that they'd always win at first, like Godzilla gets knocked down, but then he gets back up again. And then when he gets back, it's like, all right, all bets are off. You mm-hmm. guys are, it's like, you know, Rocky versus Clubber Lang. And I don't know. To me, it sort of kind of followed that Toho formula that we're getting. He's fighting these two monsters, and it's like, oh, the monsters have him down. And then he's like, he gets up. He's like, oh, okay, well, you're done.
I think that's just the regular film formula. I don't think there's ever been a hero to win in the second act.
Yeah, you better not.
And then they're like, oh, yep, that's great. But you know, Roxy, you had a question about the Mutus in particular.
Yeah,
I enjoyed them for what they were.
They're like aliens.
They were like, they looked like spidery weird things. Yeah. I was grossed out by them. I was like, ew.
Yeah, they were kind of gross. I mean, like, they also had Starship Trooper kind of thing.
Yeah,
as well.
I noticed that they're like a big cockroach thing, mm-hmm. and
the eggs were the
it was weird.
Oh,
yeah.
They went to that full was, yeah. length on
it was
that.
Like aliens.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
Whatever. Oh, and somebody wrote some article just about these eggs, about how because they ended up being a cocoon, they should have looked different, like a certain kind of egg.
Yeah, they should have been in a larval state. Yeah, a pupa state.
I was like,
it is.
Ooh, that is too much for me. I don't really care about that.
this person absolutely hate the movie because of the cocoons versus. Yeah.
But they
really
didn't mention anything other than that. So. I guess they were fixated on that one point. Yeah, on the cocoon.
But the Mutos, I thought that they did a really
good job. As if we knew
job.
The stages of a Muto.
Right, of a Muto.
I know.
Well, there's a pupal stage, the larval stage. Yeah.
It was the salmon sushi that you get. The salmon eggs is what they look
the
like.
The row, yeah.
Yeah, the row. I thought they did a really good job with the Muto. And again, I had no problem. Again, when I look back at the 1998 version, I one of the criticisms was that well, Godzilla doesn't look like that. Mm-hmm. And you know, it was like, oh, it's just, that was one of the things that bothered me. Like, I couldn't get, like, that's not Godzilla. I want him to look sort of kind of like Godzilla. And this one, at least facially and bulk-wise, I mean, Godzilla is this big, bulky thing, and he's got his arms that he uses to punch with or whatever. Mm-hmm. And when his spine's lit up, I thought, I don't know. For me, I thought they nailed it. It's a far marked improvement from the 1998.
I don't even remember the 98 version.
So it was a lizard. He looks very iguana-esque.
Yes. Iguana-esque. Okay, there you go.
Yeah. But, yeah. I don't know. I didn't necessarily mind as much.
I do remember seeing the first time I said, really? That's it? That's him? You're going to go with it? That's what I thought.
Nicole.
That's what I thought.
I did find, and I'm stealing this from Roxy. Research today provided by Roxy Stryer for Phil's Feet Tech. I found it interesting that most of the visual effects shots, there was less than 1,000 overall, but most of them were of Godzilla. Which, if we're talking about the Mutus and Godzilla, and there's two of these things, and we, for me, I felt like we saw, I'd have to do the actual screen time. I felt like we saw more Mutus.
Yeah.
So the fact that we got more visual effects of Godzilla versus the two of them is alarming.
It is.
But I guess that's the fact. So what do I know?
The one strange thing, well, going back to the train with the warheads on it or whatever in the train. That huge Muto sitting on top of the hill, and they completely can't see. That's not, really, he's right behind you. Nobody, you can't see that guy.
Actually, yeah. Rox, you have a great anecdote.
Well, he's huge. He's 300 feet. What? And you missed that? Hey, sharp guy.
No, the same thing happens when they're on the trains too. Yeah, and he's standing. Oh,
that's
what
I'm talking about. Yeah, that's the part I'm talking about. Yeah.
No, but there's an anecdote with the cinematographer Seamus McGravy. Rox, you want to read it?
No, go.
Why? I'm stealing all your stuff.
You're not.
No, because
you're the boss man. I give you the things. Take them for yourself. Yeah, steal them. Don't give me any credit.
No,
what are you doing?
Yeah, it's funny you say that you couldn't see them because the cinematographer, I guess, Dawn of the Planet of the Apes was shooting basically right next door to them. You know, quote unquote.
Right.
And so he literally, at a lakeside set, he walked onto the set of Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and thought he was on the right set because of the light meters were the same and everything was just dark and eerie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he
got confused in his own set. So I could see
talk about your
see
evolutionary shift. We go from Godzilla to the Planet of the Apes.
And it looks the exact same. We've made no progress.
That's right.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it's a funny anecdote, but you know, I mean, I guess you could understand why they might not be able to see the Mutus. Plus, I mean, have those guys seen a Mutu in real life? They don't know what they're looking for.
Well, they know he's a big ass bug.
But don't forget, well, if I'm correct too, an EMP.
It's not like
pulse
that you're that big and you're on a mountain. You're not going to make a little noise when he's moving. I mean, how could that? You know,
right? Just talking about other random things now that I'm looking at these facts. So there were a few continuity issues, which I didn't mind because of a movie at this scale, like sometimes it's
every
hard.
Movie has continuity
issues. Yeah, of course. But the one issue that I didn't have to do research, whatever, it just stood out to me while I was watching the movie and I was like, huh? Is that scene where they're sitting in the car, it's and about the birthday, and they say, oh, we made you a birthday sign, and then later on says, it's your birthday, and he's like, it's my birthday. And I'm like, she just told you he made you a birthday banner.
And you just acknowledged it.
And then 2 minutes later, you say, it's my birthday, and you're shocked. What scene were you just
in? I don't know.
It was the weirdest thing.
I don't think he was really shocked. I think it was like, it's my birthday.
No, but I had the same feeling. I went,
what?
You didn't catch that?
Yeah, I thought it was so weird.
It was very odd to
me. And I thought, you know, sometimes movies get to a certain point and then very close to the end, somebody's like, ooh, that's a glaring issue.
Yeah.
How did nobody say, this is an issue? Like, that, to me, that was a clear cut rookie issue. What is that? It was just so bizarre.
I don't know. I didn't believe that he was truly shocked that it was his birthday. I think that
that's not the thing that she's, I don't think it's the shock that she's talking about.
It's that he acknowledged
it. He acknowledged it was his birthday earlier and then wasn't.
Yeah.
I think it was just.
He acknowledges it and then that and then it was just bizarre. It didn't work. It wasn't accurate.
If it were supposed to be a joke and like he didn't acknowledge that he didn't get it, it's like what? Didn't play at all. That joke did not land if it was a joke.
Was it a joke? I don't know.
I don't think it was, but I think it was my point was, if joke. It doesn't land as a joke, then get it out. Because I went, what are you doing?
Yeah.
You made your leads look like dolts.
Yeah, yeah, like they're not paying attention. Yeah. No connect. I don't know. It was a weird moment. That was all. That was the only, of all the other, you know, there were some things people were annoyed about. The fact that when Godzilla swam under the bridge, he didn't hit any of the boats, but then when he stands up, the water hits him at knee level, so the water would have been tall enough. You know, that kind of stuff doesn't bother me.
You're very forgiving.
Yeah, I'm a little forgiving with that stuff. But this actual scene was like, I couldn't even, and it was so early on in the movie that I was like, oh God, please don't let there be more.
And see, and I appreciated the bridge scene because you had that great, like, he's going underneath the bridge.
You're talking about the Golden Gate?
Yeah, the Golden Gate. Yeah, the Golden Gate Bridge. And, you know, you see the big tail, which sort of, like, stops because, like, the rest of his body is so big, it's just got to catch up with him. He's already, I don't know. I thought the bridge scene was awesome to me.
I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to go back because I did find an article that I'd read where the writer of the movie was asked.
Which
specifically,
one? There's two.
There's five.
Five? Wow.
Yeah, five. But only one that's credited.
Max Bornstein.
Max Bornstein.
Yeah. And he was asked specifically, how did you decide when Godzilla would appear in the movie? He doesn't show up for a while. And his answer is, you know, is it's a balance between suspense and reveals. People are going to react differently to it, which I think we've proven here. There are people who are going to appreciate the slow build, and there are people who are going to want rock'em sock'em robots from the very beginning. It's a matter of taste and a matter of choice. He goes, it's done less these days because CGI has allowed us to show whatever we want when we want, which was going back to what earlier, like, are we just conditioned because we're able to see a lot of stuff?
You
up
know
front?
What's just kind of side note, but, you know, sort of in particular, now with so many of the Lord of the Rings movies and now the Hobbit movies, and Viggo Mortensen actually came out and said, you know, that he disliked making the second and third of the Lord of the Rings because it had so much CGI and, like, he couldn't grasp any of it, and there was no real connection there, no real tissue.
Easy.
Yeah, and that could happen. Yeah, absolutely.
And so in that respect, I mean, I can appreciate this movie kind of perhaps going against the grain. I mean, you know, John saying it's, you know.
And I'm not an advocate for showing me everything.
Right.
I don't like those. I like the mystique, but this
John loves video games.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's me. Especially first person ones.
But just going on, he's like, you know, there's no longer the necessity of withholding, but necessity is the mother of invention. Is there was something great about the suspense that was built up when you didn't see Jaws in that full, in the full until the end of the movie. He goes, there are all these creative, interesting things you can do without showing him. But by doing so, the movie becomes incredibly suspenseful. And perhaps it's a reason why Jaws 2 becomes a lot less interesting. Now, for those of us, like you had brought it up, there was a reason why the shark wasn't seen a lot in Jaws, especially at the beginning. It's because he wasn't working. So we had happy accidents, and we should do a Jaws thing because I think it's very interesting. But his point is, too, is, you know, now today we do have all the tools and we can show you everything. And I only go back because
here's the suspense worked because we thought there was only one monster up until we got to that plant. And it was like, what? Wait, is that Godzilla? That's a spidery, weird Godzilla.
Yeah.
Right. Ew. You know, and it's like,
two spidery weirds.
I'd love to know if people thought that was actually Godzilla.
Oh, when it first came out?
Yeah.
At the power plant.
In the Philippines?
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Because
that
this
was in
is
Japan.
You guys know this is my
Janjira.
first Godzilla film
crawled out from the Philippines.
Oh, beg your pardon.
Yeah,
I think.
But then it hatched. Sorry, Roxy, I'll let you speak.
No, that's fine.
It hatched in Janjira. You know, it escaped.
Right.
And what,
But you were talking about when it came out in Janjira, right? As a spider thing.
Yeah. With the seismic readings.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, there was no indication other than that. You know, to kind of say like, oh, hey, there's multiple of these things.
Yeah.
The thing you're about to see is not, in fact, Godzilla. So I would love to know a statistic of...
Well, I'm about to speak on that a little bit because you guys know...
we should listen.
No, you guys know that this was my first Godzilla movie.
Ever?
Yeah, this is my first Godzilla movie. And so I'm a newbie to the subject matter. And when we were going, I actually made a couple of really ignorant comments to Phil, like, is this like Joe Young? Is this like
after
like what am I walking into? And he's like, just wait for the movie. So the first thing we see is the Muto, and I was like, that's really not what I was picturing, but okay. And and then they label it as Muto, and I was like, oh, I'm starting to get this. So absolutely, when the first thing comes out, if you don't know Godzilla, like I don't, like the ignorant girl that I am sometimes, then you realize, oh, wait, that's not... And then I didn't even know. Is Godzilla good? You're thinking Destroyer. I'm thinking, I have no idea what this is.
You don't know what you're getting.
I have no idea what I'm getting. So I like the Godzilla that we got in some sense. I didn't in others, but I was really glad that Muto wasn't Godzilla.
I mean, I think it worked up until that point, but
it's a
then
good villain.
I think, you know, it worked great, but once you finally reveal Godzilla, I think because people know how Godzilla looks, and especially
they expect,
then you're okay to kind of relieve the suspense part of it and just make it a monster bash.
Which is what they did. Yeah. And again, when we talk about these monster movies too, you know, again, the original Godzilla, you know, was a product of its time. Like they couldn't, we had King Kong in 1937?
The first one, sure.
Somewhere. And Ray Harryhausen had worked on that. He was one of the special effects guys. It was done with stop motion animation. And even to today, I think that King Kong looks great. You know, I mean, I appreciate the artistry that went into making him come to life. But when it came in 1954 or 53, when they were filming this Godzilla, they didn't want to take the painstaking time to do stop motion. And they didn't have the time nor the budget to do it. So the easiest thing that they could do is hire modelers, build a model, and they actually built a rubber suit. And they said, get in there and... you know, and they film that. And again, though, I appreciate the cleverness of that.
Well, you just said necessity.
Yeah, and when you watch that Godzilla, there is something to be said about how they are able to... Yes, today we go, it looks fake because of CG. Mm-hmm. But the shots that they were able to get and what they were able to accomplish by a man in a rubber suit, I still think is really cool. So, and today they used motion capture, which is yet another version of a man in a rubber suit.
It's a digital one.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And just going a little further than that, now we have so many different things and that we have this 3D thing, which is a whole new, and I only saw it in 3D. I know, Phil, you saw it in 3D and not in 3D. Is that correct?
Yes.
What were the different experiences? Like, same, I don't know if you guys, oh, you did it also. Mm-hmm. I want to know from you guys, was one so blew it out of the water?
I mean, I enjoyed the 3D part of it. You know, for this, I don't think every movie should be 3D, but for this one in particular, I actually did enjoy it in 3D. I think it added a little bit, especially because they were so specific with their shots, especially early on. You know, remember Ford looking out into the plant, you know, as everyone's kind of evacuating. So they tied the two together, and in 3D, it just managed to look all the more connected, you know. And then you had the great moment, obviously, with Bryan Cranston and his wife, where she's there and he's there, and you know, there's
the
that if you add depth to that, it's like, you know, you're trying to reach out to her, but you know you can't. And then obviously with Godzilla, it was good to see.
I saw it in both formats as well, and for me, I think when we talk about technology, I think we're at a great time with 3D. I think 3D has finally living up to its potential. I think it took a while, and I think people were trying to rush it. And then thank God for people like a James Cameron who really took the time to massage the technology and use it to how it should be done. And we're now at this really cool time when I think they're being more selective to the movies that they're going to put out in 3D. So we're not getting like a big barrage of them. They're taking their time and doing in the like this wasn't filmed in 3D, you know. I like how they take their time in converting it to 3D, and I think the past couple of 3D movies that I've seen, like Captain America Winter Soldier, I thought looked amazing in 3D. And to me, it's all about the spectacle of film. You don't need it. I don't need to see like a Schindler's List in 3D or Saving Private Ryan. No. But for certain movies, like a good spectacle popcorn movie, I've been loving it. And I know the industry has been taking sort of kind of a hit. I've talked to some exhibitors, and some of them are like, oh, good God, people aren't paying the extra dollars mm-hmm. because they were burned before. And I understand the psyche. I mean, when you see a crappy
They overpromised and underdelivered in the beginning.
Yeah. That perfectly said. Yeah. And they rushed it. And when you get a Clash of the Titans conversion, we're floating heads and it's too dark. But some of this, I will say, too, is the onus of the exhibitor. I mean, you have to show 3D. What's the first thing? When you're watching a 3D movie, they say put on your glasses. Mm-hmm. Those glasses are dark, mm-hmm. okay? Some of the problem and some of the complaint has been because it's too dark on the screen. Well, they're not amping up the lumens on the light bulb because it's supposed to be brighter. It's got to be a brighter throw. Theaters are starting to get into that now. Right. So when they look... But it looks fantastic. I think we're in a great age, and I think Godzilla really utilized it well because that was a dark movie. And like I said, I'll go to when they're shooting the flares up or when they're doing
the wing expansion
from the plane. Yeah. That looked amazing when they're jumping from the plane with those wingsuits.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a perfect marriage of cinematography mm-hmm. and sound.
Yeah.
Because you have the great music that we opened this episode with.
And the theater shakes you a little bit. Yeah.
It shakes you and then you just cut and it's just
Yeah.
Yeah. I really, seeing it in 3D while they're laying on the bridge and we have the aerial view and things going under, it was so freaking fabulous that I loved it. John, what did you see it in? How did you?
I'm sure it was 1D.
You only watch it with one eye open? You were sleeping.
I didn't have the glasses on, so it was the 2D.
Okay. Yeah. Got it.
But maybe if
you had done 3D, it would have been a different experience.
It might have been, but I doubt
But maybe not.
3D doesn't, yeah.
I mean, despite the shortcomings that we're talking about, what I'm noticing at the very least is that they put a lot of care into the things that they wanted. They put a lot of care into. Mm-hmm. There's another fun fact from Roxy that, you know, they got U.S. Navy involved in this.
Yeah.
And so, okay, could this movie have been done without that? I think absolutely. But, you know, I'm not going to... It just shows the level of care that they're willing to put into this to try to, you know, make it the best product that they could.
The most realistic Godzilla they can make kind of movie. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's what I can take out of it, if nothing else.
They definitely gave a damn. I really think they tried.
Well, I think it was very important for a lot of people involved. I think it was important for Warner Brothers,
right?
Mm-hmm. You know, because they were stuck with the stigma of the 1998 mm-hmm. ones, and we have to make a really good showing.
It wasn't even their fault.
No, it wasn't. No,
it was TriStar,
right?
Yeah.
And then by hiring, you know, Gareth Edwards, who at the time had made
nothing.
He made one movie called Monsters. He made this movie, Monsters, that
but
got some
that's
attention.
That's surprising that they would turn over 180 million or whatever
160.
It is.
But when you think about it today, again, like, when you think about how studios are choosing directors to hand over a bunch of money to, a lot of these people, like, it's like, well... It's like instead of paying Sam Raimi mm-hmm. a bazillion dollars to do another Spider-Man movie, mm-hmm. we can get this guy that did 500 Days of Summer and pay him, you know, we can give him paddle balls. Like, we can pay him less, and you see what a director can do and if they have the chops. And mm-hmm. again, after watching Monsters, and I had seen Monsters before watching Godzilla, I was like, oh, okay, it makes somebody finally, it wasn't just based on economics. Mm-hmm. There was an executive who watched Monsters and said, you know, this guy has a feel. Like, he could make a monster movie, which mm-hmm. Godzilla is basically. It is. And he could probably do it within budget. And he has a style to himself and some sort of – he's got a panache. And I could see as watching it, because he uses a lot of his technique, again, cutting away from the action and then going to a video monitor. Mm-hmm. Like, he's not showing us – the gory detail, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I understand that made you upset, but to me, I sort of kind of appreciated the pull away because it made me want more.
Yeah, it had the exact opposite.
It had the exact opposite. I just understand.
Right, you just set me up, and now I don't care. Now I'm bored.
I get it.
And you're blowing it for me.
Here's the, you know, I'm still surprised in the regard, because if it's one movie, right, you can't judge against other work. And so if this is his technique and things like that, first mm-hmm. off, it might have been an experimentation of like, hey, let's try it. It's my first movie.
That's
try
good.
Anything.
Give it a shot.
Right.
And, you know, you'd have to get a lot of references too, and I don't know if this was the fact that, you know, I'm not knocking, I'm just kind of saying it as an example of, you want to make sure, because here's the thing, if someone makes a good movie, actor, director, whoever, you got to know that there's tons of other people that could take the burden if something's not going right to make it right. And so it could have been the editor to make sure that it went right. It could have been the cinematographers, the actors, everyone.
It's a group effort,
the,
of course.
You know, and so you don't know if it, okay, this movie's brilliant just because of him.
Right. You also take
especially
the heat
if it's
of it,
one movie.
Yeah.
And again, I liked his.
But they were right. They were right in this case.
I totally agree. Mm. And, you know, I enjoyed because there were nods to like Jurassic Park. I mean, like I loved, you know, you talk about the T-Rex paddock scene in Jurassic Park. It's a classic, classic scene, you know, and he sort of kind of has his little nod because there's the scene where, okay, one of the sound cues in the T-Rex paddock scene is, so they're in their Jeeps. It's pouring out. And all of a sudden you hear, like they're wiping the fog off the window to look outside. There was a scene where I'm pretty sure it was Eric, the bus driver, and you hear, and he's like, it's pouring out, and you hear the same thing. I'm like, that's totally Jurassic Park. That looks like a nod. And Gareth Edwards has that appreciation, and I think he took from that. I think he's only going to get better as a director. And
I wish he had taken a little bit more from it, because the one thing I thought it was, I thought it took itself way too seriously. I thought if it had backed off a little bit on that, not a lot. I'm not saying I wanted comedy because I did not want to. No, I did not want that.
You didn't want
to. No, but there were moments you could have in there that would, you know, I think that would have been great to have.
I
think
that.
That's a direct reflect because the TriStar version 1998, they had way too many
funny
moments.
I know.
I think it was like
they tried
no.
to get so far.
Yeah. Everyone was just no.
I agree, but that's why I think it was a balance issue for me because you couldn't have any of those.
Yeah,
because their movies have been really successful to do those. I agree that I didn't. The 1998 was too campy or whatever, and I didn't want this to be camp.
Yeah,
but it was so earnest in its effort. I was just going,
"You
okay,
call this
come
coffee?
On. It's a monster movie, exactly."
Yeah. No, well, listen, for Gareth, I mean, look, they just hired this guy to do the first spin-off Star Wars movie, so you know his star has risen exponentially since Monsters, and it helps when you have a hit like Godzilla, and nobody. You know, it's really interesting, too. The production budget on the movie is $160 million. That's just production budget. Again, for a big tentpole movie, I'm sure if you're looking at... I don't know how much X-Men cost, but Avengers was pretty lofty. You're looking at $225 million, including P&A. Mm-hmm. So Warner Brothers dumped a lot into marketing this movie.
And it's doing fine. It's making its money.
Let's just say $93 million for its opening weekend.
And I think 120 internationally.
Yeah, I mean, to date, it's about $112 million right now.
Mm-hmm. And that's in the U.S.
Yeah, globally, $216 million.
There you go.
You know, so, you know, this guy that did this little million-dollar Monsters made a bigger monster movie, and now he's, I think he's tied into the sequel of Godzilla and the next, well, the spin-off Star Wars movie.
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
Speaking of people, we talked about Bryan Cranston a lot, but speaking of Ford, it wasn't always going to be Aaron. It was, what do you guys think of these names?
I know. Oh my God.
Go ahead. I don't know.
It could have been Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Henry Cavill, Scott McNary, and Caleb Landry Jones.
I mean, I just cannot picture Joseph Gordon-Levitt in this role. I just can't. I think he's amazing, and he probably would have rose to the challenge because he usually does, but I really like the actor in this role. I thought they did a good job.
Yeah, I like Aaron Johnson, and you know, ultimately, I think that, you know, ultimately in this, I don't think casting was an issue. I think they picked the right people for the roles. So, yeah, I liked Aaron Johnson as well. Yeah. Again, the first time, it was just sort of a surprise that he was going to be the lead.
Yeah.
By default.
You know, and it's funny, though, when you break down, thinking about it, if I'm correct, if anybody can think back with me, the opening scene of the movie, the first character we are introduced to is Aaron Johnson. Well, the little boy. Right? Isn't he coming out from his room? And we hear Bryan Cranston in the background on the phone, but we see the little boy coming out, and he's like, get the...
Yeah.
And so if you go by that trope, okay, then he is the lead. We're going to be following him.
And it's the actor from that movie who starts growing leaves on his arms and legs.
Oh, Timothy Green.
Timothy, yeah.
Yeah, Timothy, yeah. Yeah, I know that, yeah.
Okay. Speaking of one of the first things we see, I mean, what did you guys think
thank
of...
Thank you.
What did you guys think of the opening title sequence? I mean, it was a little bit fast for me because I couldn't... You know, I was trying to read the credits as well as the images. I couldn't pay any attention to either, so then I just tried to choose what I was watching to do. But, you know, thank God I saw it twice.
It was sensory overload.
Yeah, it was all that.
Fast.
Yeah. Very fast. Very fast. And as far as Easter eggs that we talked about, there was one when Bryan Cranston's name is listed in the credits, there's a reference to Walter Malcolm arguing about government men in white lab coats keeping dirty secrets. This is what Cranston's character does in the movie, but his name on the screen is Joe Ford. I've searched for this reference, but only keep coming back to Cranston's two most famous roles in Breaking Bad, where he played Walter White and Malcolm in the Middle. So,
nice.
So, but things happen so fast. They mentioned the Bikini Islands, and there's a redacted credit that makes me laugh. When costume designer Sharon Davis is listed, the redacted credit claim, are these animals real? Can we prove they even exist, or are they merely men in rubber suits with with tricksters?
Yeah.
So, like, all these things are getting
redacted. Although, did you buy the whole idea that, you know, all that testing we did wasn't testing, it was us trying to kill them?
Yeah, I don't know.
Is there a way to explain it?
Yeah,
I did. I mean, I don't think... Here's the thing, there's certainly more far-fetched things, you know, when they try to tie into actual events that I've heard of that this... You know, I could get behind it. It didn't really bother me.
It was a bit of a stretch, but I was like, all right, whatever. Since we're not really going to deal with it, okay.
Well, you know, and it's interesting, too, because Monarch, that group, there was a, there is a graphic novel that's a prequel that's written by Max Bornstein. And it goes through the history of Monarch. And it talks about them. It's Dr. Tsuzawa's father who founds Monarch, and they find Godzilla, and the whole thing with the watch, the pocket watch. In the movie, you know, there was no explanation why he's holding the pocket watch, but
it's his dad's pocket watch.
But it's interesting how they bring up
my
Monarch
dad's pocket watch.
And throwing and trying to kill Godzilla back in the day, and how it's not the best idea. Go ahead.
No, I was just wondering if we still had Marissa in the booth, because I know she saw the movie and I wanted to get her overall thoughts on it, because I haven't heard anything from her. Do we have you, Marissa?
I enjoyed the movie. I mean, I've only seen a couple Godzilla movies, but I was like young when they came out, so I don't have a lot of reference of Godzilla. But overall, I enjoyed it. It was a big, fun summer popcorn movie. And I think one of my favorite scenes, and I think you guys touched upon it just a little bit, was when all of the men were parachuting out of the that aircraft, and we see their perspectives on going from a beautiful sky into darkness, into this war path area, and I thought that was really well executed.
They used lights and darks very well, and they knew, like, you know, red was a very
metaphor about it.
Orange was pretty big, too. Did everybody else catch another Easter egg that I actually thought was pretty cool? So when they get back, where Ford is with his dad, and they go back to Jangia. You know, and they go back to the house. The camera is going along, and it comes across like an aquarium. And you saw, like, on tape, masking tape or whatever, it's a Mothra.
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, all right, that's cool.
Yeah, that's a nice
You know, I was like, that was a nice little, I like that one. I don't know. I sort of kind of like the throwbacks that they did, and I don't know. No, you know. Well, yeah, there's a whole website that
Well, you do know. You don't not know. You said, I don't know.
I was going to say, there's a whole thing about
website dedicated to the
Easter eggs. Know your nuclear and Godzilla history. And like the Stents pilots that strengthened the USS Saratoga, a ship with direct lines to nuclear testing triggered by our nation in 1946. Almost 1 year after the bombings in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Saratoga participated in the tests, and that's the thing that he's on. And I just find, like, I always love that sort of kind of thing when they...
Yeah, it's like your hidden treasures. And if you pick up on it, it enhances the film for you. I like things like that, too.
Yeah. So I'll be interested to see when the Blu-ray comes out as well. We haven't yet touched upon because you the score, sound. Yeah, well, the sound and the score. I mean,
it just always feels like something's moving, and you know, up until the San Francisco, everything was the word to describe it was on a collision course. So right. Everything had to kind of just be like that. Which, by the way, and because of how intense the movie was, the one part that I really did enjoy was when you had the firefighters in Vegas break through that whatever penthouse. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, we hear the great music of what's already there. And, you know, it's just...
Turn around and the wall's gone.
Yeah.
I thought that was a great, clever, comedic moment.
Yeah, and the composer is a gentleman that we've talked about, mm-hmm. Alexander Desplat, who, mm-hmm. again, is just becoming a chameleon. I mean, this guy has done Philomena. He did Monuments Men, mm-hmm. where he said, you know, and now he does a monster movie. And... Again, those three scores that we just talked about, mm-hmm. couldn't be more different from one another. And, you know, I think for the most part in this score, he nailed it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he did a really good job. I pre-ordered the score. I got the score before even going into seeing Godzilla a second time. And he has a Godzilla theme. Mm-hmm. And that's something else that we talk about. I wish that there could have been, I wish there could have been more themes. John, you and I have talked about this a lot. We love when a composer does themes for mm-hmm. for
and
characters.
They don't always do them.
Always do them, but I think what he did in this movie, and he used orchestra. He didn't want this to be, for lack of a better word,
synthesized.
He didn't want synthesized or Hans Zimmerish. Mm-hmm. He didn't want it booming. He used a full-on orchestra to convey the feeling, to convey suspense and do whatever. And when you play the tracks and you listen to the track listing, I think Alexander Desplat did a great job.
Well, also, you know, in terms of the sound design, barring from Roxy again, feel free to speak to it if you want.
You gotta stop giving me credit. What if I mess some of these up? No.
Well, then you know who to blame. But, obviously, whenever you do sound design, you want to take as much care into it as much as possible. Mm. But they got 12 foot high speakers, 18 feet wide, to see what it would be like to hear Godzilla.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure that would be loud.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
They make stadium speakers.
And they spent so much time getting that roar.
I mean, they took it from the 1954 one.
Started with it.
I had no qualms with the sound in this movie. It helped with the epicness of it all. I honestly didn't notice it all of the time, which I think is good. It just helped mm-hmm. me to move along, and I think it's cool what you just read. I think that's great that they did that. It to me was really good. It wasn't the most amazing, but it was good, and it helped with the movie.
It kept my mom from falling asleep after a flight from Boston. You know, she said, why does it have to be so loud? Because it's awesome. You know, but it was the first time Godzilla roars again. The theater that we saw it at, when
it shakes.
The first time he roars. I mean, like. His roar literally tore apart wire.
Really? It blew one of our speakers in ours.
Did it really?
Yeah, it did.
Wow.
Are you being serious?
You could hear it. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
But I thought it was, you know, first I thought it was, that was something that it was part of the movie.
Yeah.
And it's so loud. Then I realized, oh no, that thing's out.
It's, when you can feel it in your chest, though, that I love that. And all of a sudden, you know, it's like the vibration in your chest. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I mean, sound design, cinematography, the movie looked, I thought, really well.
I agree.
You know, for a monster mm-hmm. movie, and, you know, for me, it's tough to discern, like, you know, you were making some great examples of talking about Jurassic Park, mm-hmm. and I'm not, for me, like, I was working at Universal at the time with mm-hmm. Jurassic Park, and there's so much going on behind the scenes and what Universal was selling me at the time, too. Since we're talking about sound, that was the birth of DTS, was Jurassic Park. And I don't know if I necessarily classify Jurassic Park as a monster movie, but I see how mm-hmm. you can make the argument. But we usually will categorize a monster movie of this as being cheesy, and maybe even the special effects not looking great. But this one, I think the tech specs were incredible. The way that it was lit, again, using the scene where they're jumping from the plane, mm-hmm. how each one had that smoke flare, yeah. and yep. you're following those tendrils down, and and the flare scene in Honolulu, I thought was amazing. Even the train scene looked amazing. The Golden Gate Bridge, the way that it was filmed and pouring out, and I don't know. I just thought.
I'm curious. I know this is a silly question, but do they normally use those flares when they halo drop like that? I mean, isn't the point to be in stealth, or do you have to do that so you don't bump into each other? Anybody know?
I was thinking that too.
Because it looked fabulous. Don't get me wrong. I thought it was great, but I also went, aren't you trying to go in there incognito?
So they did ask Navy SEALs.
Okay, well, then that doesn't mean they wouldn't change it. So.
Who are they going incognito to? I mean, it wasn't like there was an enemy down that was going to shoot back up at them.
No, but I mean,
they had to keep track of where their landing point was.
Yeah, that's what I'm asking. Yeah, I'm just curious.
I would figure. I don't know.
I don't know. It was the same question in my mind. Isn't the point to not be seen? That's Isn't right, that why we're going to all these extra lengths? But it was trumped by the fact that it was so visually pleasing to me. I was like, all right, whatever.
And wasn't there a scene, too, or reflect? Again, it's another, like, Gareth uses reflection a lot, or he'll use video monitor or something, and as they were going down, I could swear there was a scene in one of the, it could have been Ford's goggles, where there's action on the ground of, like, you know, we're seeing what he's looking at, but not through necessarily his eyes, but via reflection in the goggles. I just thought that was, the action scenes, I felt.
Yeah, and then we had that in the window, too, when Bryan Cranston was talking and behind it,
Yeah. Just good stuff. Just good stuff. I thought it was a fun popcorn movie.
All right.
73. Well, but it's funny. 73% on Rotten Tomatoes, critic wise. Certified fresh, it's a fresh movie, but there was a good handful of people who actually they echo what you were saying.
As there are a handful of people who echo what you are.
Well,
there are more on my side, though.
That's true.
Yeah, 73%.
You win, we'll give it to you. I'm somewhere in between.
So, John, nature has been restored. Godzilla stands certified fresh.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you guys want to discuss? I'll take that as a no.
I think we're good.
Yeah. All right. Well, of course, there's so many different ways we could talk about the history of Godzilla. We could talk about all the different movies leading up to this. But unfortunately, we will not, at least certainly not today.
I think we touched upon everything, history and whatnot.
You can't say everything because there's going to be one fan of like, you didn't talk. So
you're talking nothing about the script. There are five different writers on it. Why didn't you talk about each
one of
them?
Five.
All the producers.
Two of the five. Because,
well, Callahan started the first draft. He did Expendables. Then they brought in, I think it was Goyer's.
David Goyer.
He only worked a couple of weeks, so he's not credited. Then Max Bornstein.
The only people credited were Callahan and Bornstein.
And then somebody after Max to update the ages of the people, and then the last person who been reported to do the final on it was Frank Darabont.
And then Roxy Stryer.
And then Roxy Stryer, of course, yes. So Darabont was the one that apparently brought the most heart and soul to it.
You can see that. I mean, his movie, she did Shawshank Redemption, one of his greater ones. And then he also
spearheaded
Walking
Dead.
The first season.
First season.
The first season that became so great.
Didn't Darabont also do his own, what was it called, The Mist? Which was his monster movie?
If you say it so, I believe it.
I don't know.
It was The Mist. Maybe, see that movie and tell me about the heart and how good that was. But anyways.
Well, he did Shawshank, he did Green Mile. I mean, he's done some really good things.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. Well, that about wraps it up. The original point being that, hey, we didn't touch upon everything, but nonetheless, feel free to let us know what you guys thought of this movie, what you guys love. I mean, 60 years of Godzilla for all of us to enjoy.
Godzilla's back!
Godzilla.
So we have a new fan to the Godzilla franchise. It only took her 60 years.
I hope Godzilla loses a few pounds before his next coming.
He's working out.
Because, he's been dormant for 10 years now, so he gained a little weight.
He's lifting up
a
couple
on
of
a couch.
Underwater. Yeah, he's pushing apart the Marianas Trench as we speak. He's working out.
Well, it's been fun talking with you. Yes, we've just talked about the movie with the Breaking Bad guy.
The Breaking Bad guy.
Yep. It's been fun. Let us know your thoughts. Info at Anatomy of a Movie, YouTube.com/Anatomy of a Movie, AnatomyofMovie.com, Movie Anatomy on Twitter.
Wow, we're all over.
Every
iteration
iTunes,
you can imagine.
Anywhere.
The only other person with actual social media handles is Roxy Stryer.
And you can find me at Roxy Stryer.
See how simple that was?
See, that's great.
If you want to get in touch with Dimitri or John, you have to go through Anatomy of a Movie first.
Oh, you can't. You just can't. No.
Yeah. We fall off the radar.
We've got a lot of great movies coming up. We've got an X-Men special where we talk about the franchises that have come before X-Men Days of Future Past. Why? Because, of course, next week we'll be doing X-Men Days of Future Past with composer, editor, John Ottman.
John Ottman. Can't wait.
Yeah.
That's going to be a lot of fun.
Let's say that again. John Ottman in the studio.
He's an idol. I'm a big fan.
Yeah.
Can't wait.
It's great.
And you'll guys be getting, Sarah Stratton back, too.
Oh.
Who's
can't wait.
No.
Wait.
Who?
I don't know.
Who?
I don't recall. What are you talking
can't
about?
Can't wait. I'm such a big fan. Wait, we're talking John Ottman still?
No.
Sarah? No.
All right. Thank you, Marissa Serafini, in the booth. By the way, you can follow Serafini TV on Twitter as well. And until next time, this has been Anatomy Movie. We would like to thank you, and it's been fun.
Producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, and the rest of the Anatomy of a Movie staff, we would like to thank you for listening and subscribing to the show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email or tweet us. I'm Sir Richard Wentworth, and this has been Anatomy of a Movie.